1. Would the last 30 days have been notably better if I'd been able to use this service? 2. Did people care that I wasn't using this service? If your answer is no to both questions, quit the service permanently. If your answer was a clear yes, then return to using the service. If your answers are qualified or ambiguous, it's up to you whether you return to the service, though I would encourage you to lean toward quitting. You can always rejoin later. This strategy picks specifically on social media because among the different network tools that can claim your time and attention, these services, if used without limit, can be particularly devastating to your quest to work deeper. They offer personalized information arriving on an unpredictable, intermittent schedule, making them massively addictive and therefore capable of severely damaging your attempts to schedule and succeed with any act of concentration. Given these dangers, you might expect that more knowledge workers would avoid these tools altogether, especially those like computer programmers or writers whose livelihood explicitly depends on the outcome of deep work. But part of what makes social media insidious is that the companies that profit from your attention have succeeded with a masterful marketing coup, convincing our culture that if you don't use their products, you might miss out. This fear that you might miss out has obvious parallels to Nicodemus's fear that the voluminous stuff in his closets might one day prove useful, which is why I'm suggesting a corrective strategy that parallels his packing party. By spending a month without these services, you can replace your fear that you might miss out on events, on conversations, on shared cultural experience with a dose of reality. For most people, this reality will confirm something that seems obvious only once you've done the hard work of freeing yourself from the marketing messages surrounding these tools. They're not really all that important in your life. The reason why I ask you to not announce your 30-day experiment is because, for some people, another part of the delusion that binds them to social media is the idea that people want to hear what you have to say, and that they might be disappointed if you suddenly leave them bereft of your commentary. I'm being somewhat facetious here in my wording, but this underlying sentiment is nonetheless common and important to tackle. As of this writing, for example, the average number of followers for a Twitter user is 208. When you know that more than 200 people volunteered to hear what you have to say, it's easy to begin to believe that your activities on these services are important. Speaking from experience, as someone who makes a living trying to sell my ideas to people, this is a powerfully addictive feeling. But here's the reality of audiences in a social media era. Before these services existed, building an audience of any size beyond your immediate friends and family required hard, competitive work. In the early 2000s, for example, anyone could start a blog, but to gain even just a handful of unique visitors per month required that you actually put in the work to deliver information that's valuable enough to capture someone's attention. I know this difficulty well. My first blog was started in the fall of 2003. It was called, cleverly enough, Inspiring Moniker. I used it to muse on my life as a 21-year-old college student. There were, I'm embarrassed to admit, long stretches where no one read it, a term I'm using literally. As I learned in the decade that followed, a period in which I patiently and painstakingly built an audience for my current blog, Study Hacks, from a handful of readers to hundreds of thousands per month, is that earning people's attention online is hard, hard work. Except now it's not. Part of what fueled social media's rapid ascent, I contend, is its ability to short-circuit this connection between the hard work of producing real value and the positive reward of having people pay attention to you. It has instead replaced this timeless capitalist exchange with a shallow collectivist alternative. I'll pay attention to what you say if you pay attention to what I say, regardless of its value. A blog or magazine or television program that contain the content that typically populates a Facebook wall or Twitter feed, for example, would attract, on average, no audience. But when captured within the social conventions of these services, that same content will attract attention in the form of likes and comments. The implicit agreement motivating this behavior is that in return for receiving, for the most part, undeserved attention from your friends and followers, you'll return the favor by lavishing, similarly undeserved, attention on them. You like my status update, and I'll like yours. This agreement gives everyone a simulacrum of importance without requiring much effort in return. By dropping off these services without notice, you can test the reality of your status as a content producer. For most people and most services, the news might be sobering. No one outside your closest friends and family will likely even notice you've signed off. I recognize that I come across as curmudgeonly when talking about this issue. Is there any other way to tackle it? But it's important to discuss, because this quest for self-importance plays an important role in convincing people to continue to thoughtlessly fragment their time and attention. For some people, of course, this 30-day experiment will be difficult and generate lots of issues. If you're a college student or online personality, for example, the abstention will complicate your life and will be noted. But for most, I suspect, the net result of this experiment, if not a massive overhaul in your internet habits, will be a more grounded view of the role social media plays in your daily existence. These services aren't necessarily, as advertised, the lifeblood of our modern connected world. They're just products developed by private companies, funded lavishly, marketed carefully, and designed, ultimately, to capture, then sell, your personal information and attention to advertisers. They can be fun, but in the scheme of your life and what you want to accomplish, they're a lightweight whimsy, one unimportant distraction among many threatening to derail you from something deeper. Or maybe social media tools are at the core of your existence. You won't know either way until you sample life without them. Don't use the internet to entertain yourself. Arnold Bennett was an English writer born near the turn of the 20th century, a tumultuous time for his home country's economy. The Industrial Revolution, which had been roaring for decades by this point, had wrenched enough surplus capital from the empire's resources to generate a new class, the white-collar worker. It was now possible to have a job in which you spent a set number of hours a week in an office, and in exchange, received a steady salary sufficient to support a household. Such a lifestyle is blandly familiar in our current age, but to Bennett and his contemporaries, it was novel and in many ways distressing. Chief among Bennett's concerns was that members of this new class were missing out on the opportunities it presented to live a full life. Take the case of a Londoner who works in an office, whose office hours are from 10 to 6, and who spends 50 minutes morning and night in traveling between his house door and his office door, Bennett writes in his 1910 self-help classic, How to Live on 24 Hours a Day. This hypothetical London salaryman, he notes, has a little more than 16 hours left in the day beyond these work-related hours. To Bennett, this is a lot of time. But most people in this situation, tragically, don't realize its potential. The great and profound mistake which my typical man makes in regard to his day, he elaborates, is that even though he doesn't particularly enjoy his work, seeing it as something to get through, he persists in looking upon those hours from 10 to 6 as the day, to which the 10 hours preceding them and the 6 hours following them are nothing but a prologue and epilogue. This is an attitude that Bennett condemns as utterly illogical and unhealthy. What's the alternative to this state of affairs? Bennett suggests that his typical man see his 16 free hours as a day within a day, explaining, during those 16 hours he is free. He is not a wage earner. He is not preoccupied with monetary cares. He is just as good as a man with a private income. Accordingly, the typical man should instead use this time as an aristocrat would, to perform rigorous self-improvement, a task that, according to Bennett, involves primarily reading great literature and poetry. Bennett wrote about these issues more than a century ago. You might expect that in the intervening decades, a period in which this middle class exploded in size worldwide, our thinking about leisure time would have evolved, but it has not. If anything, with the rise of the internet and the lowbrow attention economy it supports, the average 40-hour week employee, especially those in my tech-savvy millennial generation, has seen the quality of his or her leisure time remain degraded, consisting primarily of a blur of distracted clicks on least common denominator digital entertainment. If Bennett were brought back to life today, he'd likely fall into despair at the lack of progress in this area of human development. To be clear, I'm indifferent to the moral underpinnings behind Bennett's suggestions. His vision of elevating the souls and minds of the middle class by reading poetry and great books feels somewhat antiquated and classist. But the logical foundation of his proposal, that you both should and can make deliberate use of your time outside work, remains relevant today, especially with respect to the goal of this rule, which is to reduce the impact of network tools on your ability to perform deep work. In more detail, in the strategies discussed so far in this rule, we haven't spent much time yet on a class of network tools that are particularly relevant to the fight for depth. Entertainment-focused websites designed to capture and hold your attention for as long as possible. At the time of this writing, the most popular examples of such sites include the Huffington Post, BuzzFeed, Business Insider, and Reddit. This list will undoubtedly continue to evolve, but what this general category of site shares is the use of carefully crafted titles and easily digestible content, often honed by algorithms to be maximally attention-catching. Once you've landed on one article in one of these sites, links on the side or bottom of the page beckon you to click on another, then another. Every available trick of human psychology, from listing titles as popular or trending, to the use of arresting photos, is used to keep you engaged. At this particular moment, for example, some of the most popular articles on BuzzFeed include 17 words that mean something totally different when spelled backward, and 33 dogs winning at everything. These sites are especially harmful after the workday is over, where the freedom in your schedule enables them to become central to your leisure time. If you're waiting in line, or waiting for the plot to pick up in a TV show, or waiting to finish eating a meal, they provide a cognitive crutch to ensure you eliminate any chance of boredom. As I argued in rule number 2, however, such behavior is dangerous, as it weakens your mind's general ability to resist distraction, making deep work difficult later when you really want to concentrate. To make matters worse, these network tools are not something you join, and therefore they're not something you can remove from your life by quitting, rendering the previous two strategies irrelevant. They're always available, just a click away. Fortunately, Arnold Bennett identified the solution to this problem 100 years earlier. Put more thought into your leisure time. In other words, this strategy suggests that when it comes to your relaxation, don't default to whatever catches your attention at the moment, but instead dedicate some advanced thinking to the question of how you want to spend your day within a day. Addictive websites of the type mentioned previously thrive in a vacuum. If you haven't given yourself something to do in a given moment, they'll always beckon as an appealing option. If you instead fill this free time with something of more quality, their grip on your attention will loosen. It's crucial, therefore, that you figure out in advance what you're going to do with your evenings and weekends before they begin. Structured hobbies provide good fodder for these hours, as they generate specific actions with specific goals to fill your time. A set program of reading, a la Bennett, where you spend regular time each night making progress on a series of deliberately chosen books, is also a good option, as is, of course, exercise or the enjoyment of good in-person company. In my own life, for example, I managed to read a surprising number of books in a typical year, given the demands on my time as a professor, writer, and father. On average, I'm typically reading 3 to 5 books at a time. This is possible because one of my favorite pre-planned leisure activities after my kids' bedtime is to read an interesting book. As a result, my smartphone and computer and the distractions they can offer typically remain neglected between the end of the workday and the next morning. At this point, you might worry that adding such structure to your relaxation will defeat the purpose of relaxing, which many believe requires complete freedom from plans or obligations. Won't a structured evening leave you exhausted, not refreshed, the next day at work? Bennett, to his credit, anticipated this complaint. As he argues, such worries misunderstand what energizes the human spirit. What? You say that full energy given to those 16 hours will lessen the value of the business 8? Not so. On the contrary, it will assuredly increase the value of the business 8. One of the chief things which my typical man has to learn is that the mental faculties are capable of a continuous hard activity. They do not tire like an arm or a leg. All they want is change, not rest, except in sleep. In my experience, this analysis is spot on. If you give your mind to something meaningful to do throughout all your waking hours, you'll end the day more fulfilled and begin the next one more relaxed than if you instead allow your mind to bathe for hours in semi-conscious and unstructured web surfing. To summarize, if you want to eliminate the addictive pull of entertainment sites on your time and attention, give your brain a quality alternative. Not only will this preserve your ability to resist distraction and concentrate, but you might even fulfill Arnold Bennett's ambitious goal of experiencing, perhaps for the first time, what it means to live and not just exist. Rule number 4. Drain the shallows. In the summer of 2007, the software company 37 Signals, now called Basecamp, launched an experiment. They shortened their work week from 5 days to 4. Their employees seemed to accomplish the same amount of work with one less day, so they made this change permanent. Every year, from May through October, 37 Signals employees work only Monday to Thursday, with the exception of customer support, which still operates the full week. As company co-founder Jason Fried quipped in a blog post about the decision, people should enjoy the weather in the summer. It didn't take long before the grumbles began in the business press. A few months after Fried announced his company's decision to make 4-day weeks permanent, journalist Tara Weiss wrote a critical piece for Forbes titled, "Why a 4-Day Work Week Doesn't Work." She summarized her problem with this strategy as follows. Packing 40 hours into 4 days isn't necessarily an efficient way to work. Many people find that 8 hours are tough enough. Requiring them to stay for an extra 2 could cause morale and productivity to decrease. Fried was quick to respond. In a blog post titled, "Forbes Misses the Point of the 4-Day Work Week," he begins by agreeing with Weiss's premise that it would be stressful for employees to cram 40 hours of effort into 4 days. But, as he clarifies, that's not what he's suggesting. The point of the 4-day work week is about doing less work, he writes. It's not about 4 10-hour days, it's about 4 normalish 8-hour days. This might seem confusing at first. Fried earlier claimed that his employees get just as much done in 4 days as in 5 days. Now, however, he's claiming that his employees are working fewer hours. How can both be true? The difference, it turns out, concerns the role of shallow work. As Fried explains, Very few people work even 8 hours a day. You're lucky if you get a few good hours in between all the meetings, interruptions, web surfing, office politics, and personal business that permeate the typical workday. Fewer official working hours help squeeze the fat out of the typical work week. Once everyone has less time to get their stuff done, they respect that time even more. People become stingy with their time, and that's a good thing. They don't waste it on things that just don't matter. When you have fewer hours, you usually spend them more wisely. In other words, the reduction in the 37 Signals workweek disproportionately eliminated shallow as compared to deep work, and because the latter was left largely untouched, the important stuff continued to get done. The shallow stuff that can seem so urgent in the moment turned out to be unexpectedly dispensable. A natural reaction to this experiment is to wonder what would happen if 37 Signals had gone one step further. If eliminating hours of shallow work had little impact on the results produced, what would happen if they not only eliminated shallow work, but then replaced this newly recovered time with more deep work? Fortunately for our curiosity, the company soon put this bolder idea to the test as well. Fried had always been interested in the policies of technology companies like Google that gave their employees 20% of their time to work on self-directed projects. While he liked this idea, he felt that carving one day out of an otherwise busy week was not enough to support the type of unbroken deep work that generates true breakthroughs. "I'd take 5 days in a row over 5 days spread out over 5 weeks," he explained. "So our theory is that we'll see better results when people have a long stretch of uninterrupted time." To test this theory, 37 Signals implemented something radical. The company gave its employees the entire month of June off to work deeply on their own projects. This month would be a period free of any shallow work obligations. No status meetings, no memos, and, blessedly, no PowerPoint. At the end of the month, the company held a pitch day in which employees pitched the ideas they'd been working on. Summarizing the experiment in an Inc. magazine article, Fried dubbed it a success. The pitch day produced two projects that were soon put into production: a better suite of tools for handling customer support, and a data visualization system that helps the company understand how their customers use their products. These projects are predicted to bring substantial value to the company, but they almost certainly would not have been produced in the absence of the unobstructed deep work time provided to the employees. To tease out their potential required dozens of hours of unimpeded effort. "How can we afford to put our business on hold for a month to mess around with new ideas?" Fried asked rhetorically. "How can we afford not to?" 37 Signals experiments highlight an important reality. The shallow work that increasingly dominates the time and attention of knowledge workers is less vital than it often seems in the moment. For most businesses, if you eliminated significant amounts of this shallowness, their bottom line would likely remain unaffected. And as Jason Fried discovered, if you not only eliminate shallow work, but also replace this recovered time with more of the deep alternative, not only will the business continue to function, it can become more successful. This rule asks you to apply these insights to your personal work life. The strategies that follow are designed to help you ruthlessly identify the shallowness in your current schedule, then cull it down to minimum levels, leaving more time for the deep efforts that ultimately matter most. Before diving into the details of these strategies, however, we should first confront the reality that there's a limit to this anti-shallow thinking. The value of deep work vastly outweighs the value of shallow. But this doesn't mean that you must quixotically pursue a schedule in which all of your time is invested in depth. For one thing, a non-trivial amount of shallow work is needed to maintain most knowledge work jobs. You might be able to avoid checking your email every 10 minutes, but you won't likely last long if you never respond to important messages. In this sense, we should see the goal of this rule as taming shallow work's footprint in your schedule, not eliminating it. Then there's the issue of cognitive capacity. Deep work is exhausting because it pushes you toward the limit of your abilities. Performance psychologists have extensively studied how much such efforts can be sustained by an individual in a given day. In their seminal paper on deliberate practice, Anders Ericsson and his collaborators survey these studies. They note that for someone new to such practice, citing in particular a child in the early stages of developing an expert-level skill, an hour a day is a reasonable limit. For those familiar with the rigors of such activities, the limit expands to something like 4 hours, but rarely more. The implication is that once you've hit your deep work limit in a given day, you'll experience diminishing rewards if you try to cram in more. Shallow work, therefore, doesn't become dangerous until after you add enough to begin to crowd out your bounded deep efforts for the day. At first, this caveat might seem optimistic. The typical workday is 8 hours. The most adept deep thinker cannot spend more than 4 of these hours in a state of true depth. It follows that you can safely spend half the day wallowing in the shallows without adverse effect. The danger missed by this analysis is how easily this amount of time can be consumed, especially once you consider the impact of meetings, appointments, calls, and other scheduled events. For many jobs, these time drains can leave you with surprisingly little time left for solo work. My job as a professor, for example, is traditionally less plagued by such commitments, but even so, they often take large chunks out of my time, especially during the academic year. Turning to a random day in my calendar from the previous semester, I'm writing this during a quiet summer month. For example, I see I had a meeting from 11 to 12, another from 1 to 2:30, and a class to teach from 3 to 5. My 8-hour workday in this example is already reduced by 4 hours. Even if I squeezed all remaining shallow work, emails, tasks, into a single half hour, I'd still fall short of the goal of 4 hours of daily deep work. Put another way, even though we're not capable of spending a full day in a state of blissful depth, this reality shouldn't reduce the urgency of reducing shallow work, as the typical knowledge workday is more easily fragmented than many suspect. To summarize, I'm asking you to treat shallow work with suspicion, because its damage is often vastly underestimated, and its importance vastly overestimated. This type of work is inevitable, but you must keep it confined to a point where it doesn't impede your ability to take full advantage of the deeper efforts that ultimately determine your impact. The strategies that follow will help you act on this reality. Schedule every minute of your day. If you're between the ages of 25 and 34 years old and live in Britain, you likely watch more television than you realize. In 2013, the British TV Licensing Authority surveyed television watchers about their habits. The 25 to 34-year-olds taking the survey estimated that they spend somewhere between 15 and 16 hours per week watching TV. This sounds like a lot, but it's actually a significant underestimate. We know this because when it comes to television watching habits, we have access to the ground truth. The Broadcasters Audience Research Board, the British equivalent of the American Nielsen Company, places meters in a representative sample of households. These meters record, without bias or wishful thinking, exactly how much people actually watch. The 25 to 34-year-olds who thought they watched 15 hours a week, it turns out, watch more like 28 hours. This bad estimate of time usage is not unique to British television watching. When you consider different groups self-estimating different behaviors, similar gaps stubbornly remain. In a Wall Street Journal article on the topic, business writer Laura Vanderkam pointed out several more such examples. A survey by the National Sleep Foundation revealed that Americans think they're sleeping, on average, somewhere around 7 hours a night. The American Time Use Survey, which has people actually measure their sleep, corrected this number to 8.6 hours. Another study found that people who claimed to work 60 to 64 hours per week were actually averaging more like 44 hours per week, while those claiming to work more than 75 hours were actually working less than 55. These examples underscore an important point. We spend much of our day on autopilot, not giving much thought to what we're doing with our time. This is a problem. It's difficult to prevent the trivial from creeping into every corner of your schedule if you don't face, without flinching, your current balance between deep and shallow work, and then adopt the habit of pausing before action and asking, what makes the most sense right now? The strategy described in the following paragraphs is designed to force you into these behaviors. It's an idea that might seem extreme at first, but will soon prove indispensable in your quest to take full advantage of the value of deep work. Schedule every minute of your day. Here's my suggestion. At the beginning of each workday, turn to a new page of lined paper in a notebook you dedicate to this purpose. Down the left-hand side of the page, mark every other line with an hour of the day, covering the full set of hours you typically work. Now comes the important part. Divide the hours of your workday into blocks and assign activities to the blocks. For example, you might block off 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. for writing a client's press release. To do so, actually draw a box that covers the lines corresponding to these hours. Then, write press release inside the box. Not every block need be dedicated to a work task. There might be time blocks for lunch or relaxation breaks. To keep things reasonably clean, the minimum length of a block should be 30 minutes, i.e. one line on your page. This means, for example, that instead of having a unique small box for each small task on your plate for the day, respond to boss's email, submit reimbursement form, ask Carl about report. You can batch similar things into more generic task blocks. You might find it useful in this case to draw a line from a task block to the open right-hand side of the page where you can list out the full set of small tasks you plan to accomplish in that block. When you're done scheduling your day, every minute should be part of a block. You have, in effect, given every minute of your workday a job. Now, as you go through your day, use this schedule to guide you. It's here, of course, that most people will begin to run into trouble. Two things can and likely will go wrong with your schedule once the day progresses. The first is that your estimates will prove wrong. You might put aside 2 hours for writing a press release, for example, and in reality, it takes 2.5 hours. The second problem is that you'll be interrupted, and new obligations will unexpectedly appear on your plate. These events will also break your schedule. This is okay. If your schedule is disrupted, you should, at the next available moment, take a few minutes to create a revised schedule for the time that remains in the day. You can turn to a new page. You can erase and redraw blocks, or do as I do, cross out the blocks for the remainder of the day and create new blocks to the right of the old ones on the page. I draw my blocks skinny, so I have room for several revisions. On some days, you might rewrite your schedule half a dozen times. Don't despair if this happens. Your goal is not to stick to a given schedule at all costs. It's instead to maintain at all times a thoughtful say in what you're doing with your time going forward, even if these decisions are reworked again and again as the day unfolds. If you find that schedule revisions become overwhelming in their frequency, there are a few tactics that can inject some more stability. First, you should recognize that almost definitely you're going to underestimate at first how much time you require for most things. When people are new to this habit, they tend to use their schedule as an incarnation of wishful thinking, a best-case scenario for their day. Over time, you should make an effort to accurately, if not somewhat conservatively, predict the time tasks will require. The second tactic that helps is the use of overflow conditional blocks. If you're not sure how long a given activity might take, block off the expected time, then follow this with an additional block that has a split purpose. If you need more time for the preceding activity, use this additional block to keep working on it. If you finish the activity on time, however, have an alternate use already assigned for the extra block, for example, some non-urgent tasks. This allows unpredictability in your day without requiring you to keep changing your schedule on paper. For example, returning to our press release example, you might schedule 2 hours for writing the press release, but then follow it by an additional hour block that you can use to keep writing the release if needed, but otherwise assigned to catching up with email. The third tactic I suggest is to be liberal with your use of task blocks. Deploy many throughout your day and make them longer than required to handle the tasks you plan in the morning. Lots of things come up during the typical knowledge worker's day. Having regularly occurring blocks of time to address these surprises keeps things running smoothly. Before leaving you to put this strategy in practice, I should address a common objection. In my experience pitching the values of daily schedules, I found that many people worry that this level of planning will become burdensomely restrictive. Here, for example, is part of a comment from a reader named Joseph on a blog post I wrote on this topic. "I think you far understate the role of uncertainty. I worry about readers applying these observations too seriously, to the point of an obsessive and unhealthy relationship with one's schedule that seems to exaggerate the importance of minute counting over getting lost in activities, which, if we're talking about artists, is often the only really sensible course of action." I understand these concerns, and Joseph is certainly not the first to raise them. Fortunately, however, they're also easily addressed. In my own daily scheduling discipline, in addition to regularly scheduling significant blocks of time for speculative thinking and discussion, I maintain a rule that if I stumble onto an important insight, then this is a perfectly valid reason to ignore the rest of my schedule for the day, with the exception, of course, of things that cannot be skipped. I can then stick with this unexpected insight until it loses steam. At this point, I'll step back and rebuild my schedule for any time that remains in the day. In other words, I not only allow spontaneity in my schedule, I encourage it. Joseph's critique is driven by the mistaken idea that the goal of a schedule is to force your behavior into a rigid plan. This type of scheduling, however, isn't about constraint. It's instead about thoughtfulness. It's a simple habit that forces you to continually take a moment throughout your day and ask, "What makes sense for me to do with the time that remains?" It's the habit of asking that returns results, not your unyielding fidelity to the answer. I would go so far as to argue that someone following this combination of comprehensive scheduling and a willingness to adapt or modify the plan as needed will likely experience more creative insights than someone who adopts a more traditionally spontaneous approach, where the day is left open and unstructured. Without structure, it's easy to allow your time to devolve into the shallow, email, social media, web surfing. This type of shallow behavior, though satisfying in the moment, is not conducive to creativity. With structure, on the other hand, you can ensure that you regularly schedule blocks to grapple with a new idea, or work deeply on something challenging, or brainstorm for a fixed period, the type of commitment more likely to instigate innovation. Recall, for example, The discussion in rule number one about the rigid rituals followed by many great creative thinkers. And because you're willing to abandon your plan when an innovative idea arises, you're just as well suited as the distracted creative to follow up when the muse strikes. To summarize, the motivation for this strategy is the recognition that a deep work habit requires you to treat your time with respect. A good first step toward this respectful handling is the advice outlined here. Decide in advance what you're going to do with every minute of your workday. It's natural at first to resist this idea, as it's undoubtedly easier to continue to allow the twin forces of internal whim and external request to drive your schedule. But you must overcome this distrust of structure if you want to approach your true potential as someone who creates things that matter. Quantify the depth of every activity. An advantage of scheduling your day is that you can determine how much time you're actually spending in shallow activities. Extracting this insight from your schedules, however, can become tricky in practice, as it's not always clear exactly how shallow you should consider a given task. To expand on this challenge, let's start by reminding ourselves of the formal definition of shallow work that I introduced in the introduction. Shallow work, non-cognitively demanding logistical style tasks, often performed while distracted. These efforts tend not to create much new value in the world and are easy to replicate. Some activities clearly satisfy this definition. Checking email, for example, or scheduling a conference call is unquestionably shallow in nature. But the classification of other activities can be more ambiguous. Consider the following tasks. Example number one, editing a draft of an academic article that you and a collaborator will soon submit to a journal. Example number two, building a PowerPoint presentation about this quarter's sales figures. Example number three, attending a meeting to discuss the current status of an important project and to agree on the next steps. It's not obvious at first how to categorize these examples. The first two describe tasks that can be quite demanding, and the final example seems important to advance a key work objective. The purpose of this strategy is to give you an accurate metric for resolving such ambiguity, providing you with a way to make clear and consistent decisions about where given work tasks fall on the shallow to deep scale. To do so, it asks that you evaluate activities by asking a simple but surprisingly illuminating question. How long would it take, in months, to train a smart, recent college graduate with no specialized training in my field to complete this task? To illustrate this approach, let's apply this question to our examples of ambiguous tasks. Analyzing example number one. To properly edit an academic paper requires that you understand the nuances of the work so you can make sure it's being described precisely, and the nuances of the broader literature so you can make sure it's being cited properly. These requirements require cutting-edge knowledge of an academic field, a task that in the age of specialization takes years of diligent study at the graduate level and beyond. When it comes to this example, the answer to our question would therefore be quite large, perhaps on the scale of 50 to 75 months. Analyzing example number two. The second example doesn't fare so well by this analysis. To create a PowerPoint presentation that describes your quarterly sales requires three things. First, knowledge of how to make a PowerPoint presentation. Second, an understanding of the standard format of these quarterly performance presentations within your organization. And third, an understanding of what sales metrics your organization tracks and how to convert them into the right graphs. The hypothetical college graduate imagined by our question, we can assume, would already know how to use PowerPoint. And learning the standard format for your organization's presentations shouldn't require more than a week. The real question, therefore, is how long it takes a bright college graduate to understand the metrics you track, where to find the results, and how to clean those up and translate them into graphs and charts that are appropriate for a slide presentation. This isn't a trivial task, but for a bright college grad, it wouldn't require more than an additional month or so of training, so we can use 2 months as our conservative answer. Analyzing example number 3. Meetings can be tricky to analyze. They can seem tedious at times, but they're often also presented as playing a key role in your organization's most important activities. The method presented here helps cut through this veneer. How long would it take to train a bright, recent college graduate to take your place in a planning meeting? He or she would have to understand the project well enough to know its milestones and the skills of its participants. Our hypothetical grad might also need some insight into the interpersonal dynamics and the reality of how such projects are executed at the organization. At this point, you might wonder if this college grad would also need a deep expertise in the topic tackled by the project. For a planning meeting, probably not. Such meetings rarely dive into substantive content and tend to feature a lot of small talk and posturing, in which participants try to make it seem like they're committing to a lot without actually having to commit. Give a bright recent graduate 3 months to learn the ropes, and he or she could take your place without issue in such a gabfest. So we'll use 3 months as our answer. This question is meant as a thought experiment. I'm not going to ask you to actually hire a recent college graduate to take over tasks that score low. But the answers it provides will help you objectively quantify the shallowness or depth of various activities. If our hypothetical college graduate requires many months of training to replicate a task, then this indicates that the task leverages hard-won expertise. As argued earlier, tasks that leverage your expertise tend to be deep tasks, and they can therefore provide a double benefit. They return more value per time spent, and they stretch your abilities, leading to improvement. On the other hand, a task that our hypothetical college graduate can pick up quickly is one that does not leverage expertise, and therefore it can be understood as shallow. What should you do with this strategy? Once you know where your activities fall on the deep to shallow scale, bias your time toward the former. When we consider our case studies, for example, we see that the first task is something that you would want to prioritize as a good use of time, while the second and third are activities of a type that should be minimized. They might feel productive, but their return on time investment is measly. Of course, how one biases away from shallow and toward depth is not always obvious, even after you know how to accurately label your commitments. This brings us to the strategies that follow, which will provide specific guidance on how to accomplish this tricky goal. Ask your boss for a shallow work budget. Here's an important question that's rarely asked. What percentage of my time should be spent on shallow work? This strategy suggests that you ask it. If you have a boss, in other words, have a conversation about this question. You'll probably have to first define for him or her what shallow and deep work means. If you work for yourself, ask yourself this question. In both cases, settle on a specific answer. Then, and this is the important part, try to stick to this budget. The strategies that precede and follow this one will help you achieve this goal. For most people in most non-entry-level knowledge work jobs, the answer to the question will be somewhere in the 30 to 50% range. There's a psychological distaste surrounding the idea of spending the majority of your time on unskilled tasks, so 50% is a natural upper limit. While at the same time, most bosses will begin to worry that if this percentage gets too much lower than 30%, you'll be reduced to a knowledge work hermit who thinks big thoughts but never responds to emails. Obeying this budget will likely require changes to your behavior. You'll almost certainly end up forced into saying no to projects that seem infused with shallowness, while also more aggressively reducing the amount of shallowness in your existing projects. This budget might lead you to drop the need for a weekly status meeting in preference for results-driven reporting. Let me know when you've made significant progress, then we'll talk. It might also lead you to start spending more mornings in communication isolation, or decide it's not as important as you once thought to respond quickly and in detail to every CC'd email that crosses your inbox. These changes are all positive for your quest to make deep work central to your working life. On the one hand, they don't ask you to abandon your core shallow obligations, a move that would cause problems and resentment, as you're still spending a lot of time on such efforts. On the other hand, they do force you to place a hard limit on the amount of less urgent obligations you allow to slip insidiously into your schedule. This limit frees up space for significant amounts of deep effort on a consistent basis. The reason why these decisions should start with a conversation with your boss is that this agreement establishes implicit support from your workplace. If you work for someone else, this strategy provides cover when you turn down an obligation or restructure a project to minimize shallowness. You can justify the move because it's necessary for you to hit your prescribed target mix of work types. As I discussed in Chapter 2, part of the reason shallow work persists in large quantities in knowledge work is that we rarely see the total impact of such efforts on our schedules. We instead tend to evaluate these behaviors one by one in the moment, a perspective from which each task can seem quite reasonable and convenient. The tools from earlier in this rule, however, allow you to make this impact explicit. You can now confidently say to your boss, "This is the exact percentage of my time spent last week on shallow work," and force him or her to give explicit approval for that ratio. Faced with these numbers and the economic reality they clarify, it's incredibly wasteful, for example, to pay a highly trained professional to send email messages and attend meetings for 30 hours a week. A boss will be led to the natural conclusion that you need to say no to some things and to streamline others. Even if this makes life less convenient for the boss or for you or for your coworkers. Because, of course, in the end, a business's goal is to generate value, not to make sure its employees' lives are as easy as possible. If you work for yourself, this exercise will force you to confront the reality of how little time in your busy schedule you're actually producing value. These hard numbers will provide you the confidence needed to start scaling back on the shallow activities that are sapping your time. Without these numbers, it's difficult for an entrepreneur to say no to any opportunity that might generate some positive return. I have to be on Twitter. I have to maintain an active Facebook presence. I have to tweak the widgets on my blog, you tell yourself, because when considered in isolation, to say no to any one of these activities seems like you're being lazy. By instead picking and sticking with a shallow to deep ratio, you can replace this guilt-driven, unconditional acceptance with the more healthy habit of trying to get the most out of the time you put aside for shallow work, therefore still exposing yourself to many opportunities, but keeping these efforts constrained to a small enough fraction of your time and attention to enable the deep work that ultimately drives your business forward. Of course, there's always the possibility that when you ask this question, the answer is stark. No boss will explicitly answer, 100% of your time should be shallow, unless you're entry level, at which point you need to delay this exercise until you've built enough skills to add deep efforts to your official work responsibilities. But a boss might reply in so many words, as much shallow work is needed for you to promptly do whatever we need from you at the moment. In this case, the answer is still useful, as it tells you that this isn't a job that supports deep work, And a job that doesn't support deep work is not a job that can help you succeed in our current information economy. You should, in this case, thank the boss for the feedback and then promptly start planning how you can transition into a new position that values depth. Finish your work by 5:30. In the 7 days preceding my first writing these words, I participated in 65 different email conversations. Among these 65 conversations, I sent exactly 5 emails after 5:30 p.m. The immediate story told by these statistics is that, with few exceptions, I don't send emails after 5:30. But given how intertwined email has become with work in general, there's a more surprising reality hinted by this behavior. I don't work after 5:30 p.m. I call this commitment fixed schedule productivity. As I fix the firm goal of not working past a certain time, then work backward to find productivity strategies that allow me to satisfy this declaration. I've practiced fixed schedule productivity happily for more than half a decade now, and it's been crucial to my efforts to build a productive professional life centered on deep work. In the sections ahead, I will try to convince you to adopt this strategy as well. Let me start my pitch for fixed schedule productivity by first noting that, according to conventional wisdom, in the academic world I inhabit, this tactic should fail. Professors, especially junior professors, are notorious for adopting grueling schedules that extend into the night and through weekends. Consider, for example, a blog post published by a young computer science professor whom I'll call Tom. In this post, which Tom wrote in the winter of 2014, he replicates his schedule for a recent day in which he spent 12 hours at his office. This schedule includes 5 different meetings and 3 hours of administrative tasks, which he describes as tending to bushels of emails, filling out bureaucratic forms, organizing meeting notes, planning future meetings. By his estimation, he spent only 1.5 out of 12 total hours sitting in his office tackling real work, which he defines as efforts that make progress toward a research deliverable. It's no wonder that Tom feels coerced into working well beyond the standard workday. "I've already accepted the reality that I'll be working on weekends," he concludes in another post. Very few junior faculty can avoid such a fate. And yet, I have. Even though I don't work at night and rarely work on weekends, between arriving at Georgetown in the fall of 2011 and beginning work on this chapter in the fall of 2014, I've published somewhere around 20 peer-reviewed articles. I also won 2 competitive grants, published 1 non-academic book, and have almost finished writing another, which you're listening to at the moment, all while avoiding the grueling schedules deemed necessary by the Toms of the world. What explains this paradox? We can find a compelling answer in a widely disseminated article published in 2013 by an academic further along in her career, and far more accomplished than I, Radhika Nagpal, the Fred Kavli Professor of Computer Science at Harvard University. Nagpal opens the article by claiming that much of the stress suffered by tenure-track professors is self-imposed. Scary myths and scary data abound about life as a tenure-track faculty at an R1, research-focused, university, she begins, before continuing to explain how she finally decided to disregard the conventional wisdom and instead deliberately do specific things to preserve my happiness. This deliberate effort led Nagpal to enjoy her pre-tenure time tremendously. Nagpal goes on to detail several examples of these efforts, but there's one tactic in particular that should sound familiar. As Nagpal admits, early in her academic career, she found herself trying to cram work into every free hour between 7 a.m. and midnight. Because she has kids, this time, especially in the evening, was often severely fractured. It didn't take long before she decided this strategy was unsustainable. So, she set a limit of 50 hours a week and worked backward to determine what rules and habits were needed to satisfy this constraint. Nagpal, in other words, deployed fixed schedule productivity. We know this strategy didn't hurt her academic career, as she ended up earning tenure on schedule and then jumping to the full professor level after only 3 additional years, an impressive ascent. How did she pull this off? According to her article, one of the main techniques for respecting her hour limit was to set drastic quotas on the